across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone here on FreemanTV.com. Now, these 9+ years of broadcasting to you have really been a personal quest of my own. I've been seeking answers to experiences I've had in my life and trying to ask all the experts what they feel this situation is. Now, as a young boy, I was walking with my nephew on the beach. I know that we were near a submarine base, and I don't know why I know that. It was a long time ago. As we walked down this beach, it was nighttime. Suddenly, night turned to day. I looked around, just dumbfounded at what I was witnessing, and spun around fast enough to see this daylight glow disappear behind a hill off towards the ocean, towards that submarine base. Now, what that was, I have no idea. The amount of light that was brought out was beyond compare. Night had turned to day. Now, I ran into my nephew. I asked him if he remembered this night, and he had no recollection. And it seems this is the way with these type of experiences. With no hanger to hang them on, they tend to fade from our minds. I know it's difficult even to hold on to UFO experiences of my own. In 1993, Daytona Beach, sitting out at spring break. Me and my friend heading off to go to a bar, party with those there at spring break, massive crowds and all that. But before we headed to the bar, we stopped at the beach front and went up and sat on a lifeguard stand. Sitting there, we witnessed a large rectangular craft. At least I call it a craft, I don't know. It looked more like a window into another dimension. It was rectangular. It was subdivided into 4 squares and was radiating a red glow. It almost looked as if you could put your hand right through it. My friend and I sat there, transfixed, staring at this thing. I remember my finger pointing at it. Now, curiously, I don't remember the thing leaving. My only recollection of this is my finger following it as it moved away. Now, for my friend and I, this was just moments. We stood there looking at each other, jaws dropped, not a word said. Then the excitement hit us. Oh my God, what had happened? What had we had just seen? So we turned to go join the massing throngs over on Daytona Beach, going down for their spring break partying, and the streets were completely empty. We didn't know what to think of this as we walked down the main highway. And there were no cars, no people, no nothing. They were all there just moments ago. Now they're gone. I know I had thoughts of being in some sort of Twilight scenario where everyone was gone and we were the last left on planet Earth. But the brain wasn't ready to accept such a belief as this. So we carried on, went to the bar that we were heading for. And before we got there, we ran into a crowd of kids. So confused and wondering why there was no people, we questioned them to say, well, what time is it? And we had lost 5 hours of time. We knew nothing of what had occurred. Many, many years later, I'm in Lawrence, Kansas, and I run into my friend once again. Just randomly walking down the street in Lawrence, Kansas, turned out that his girlfriend was actually going to Kansas University. So I immediately invited my friend back to the house. Now, he brought up this story, our experience with the flying rectangle, without me bringing it up. And this was a true joy for me because I had told all my friends about this experience. To have it confirmed by an outside source is always something that people that witness this sort of thing really want to have. But he reminded me that once we had experienced that, found out that the party was over, we had missed it, and we were driving back home, we could not recognize any of the street signs near my neighborhood. We couldn't recognize where we needed to exit and where we needed to turn. As he told me this, I remembered it. And I could remember the feeling of looking at those street signs and them not having any meaning to me whatsoever. I still can only assume that we made it home on autopilot, as many often do. Because I did find myself home. Now, after this experience, it began that I started to see the world in a different way. And there was even times that I believed that I was shown the future. Now, I don't know. But what I do know is that I started to recognize different signs and symbols all around me that now had special significance. For the most part, I had noticed the Masonic connection to corporate logos and was able to actually identify all different aspects of Masonic ritual out of different corporate logos. But deeper in this, there was a current that seems to go to the abyss, hell, whatever you want to call it. A dark side was being presented to me. Signs and symbols that I would have never considered. Now, I came to Phillips 66 gas station and tried to identify what meaning this could have inside of Freemasonry. As I saw it, I learned that Freemasonry was connected to Kabbalism and that Kabbalism was connected to Hebrew. And so I looked into the Kabbalistic meanings of 66. And I quickly learned that this was the number of the Klephot, or the fallen angels, what in magic is known as excrement, or those that have died insane. Understanding this knowledge, I then applied it to the political spectrum. After seeing the fall of Bill Clinton, I knew that the next political mechanization needed was to force a president into office. And then W popped up on the radar. Now, being that all of this Kabbalistic magic was connected to Hebrew, therefore the number 6 would transliterate over to the number to the letter V. So now 66 became W. And from that simple note of knowing that this was connected to the dark side of magic, I predicted that this W would be forced into office. Now, the purpose of the forcing was, of course, for the aggression and the disbelief, the dispelling of the American myth. They had brought down the saxophone-playing man Bill Clinton. Now they needed to take down the system, or at least our belief in it. And exactly as I had predicted, they forced this W into office and then made it publicly known. Made it known that you should believe that Jeb Bush made this occur in Florida. Made it known so that people would start to lose their faith in the American way. From this prediction, I then knew that my next prediction was imminent. My next prediction was of a terrorist event that needed to occur in the middle of September. Knowing this code, as I had seen, I started to look for the other numbers, other symbols that would relate to this situation. And I came across the numbers 9/11, actually through H.W. Bush, as he had used this date in 1990 to announce the New World Order. So before I even knew the accursed nature of the numbers 9 and 11, I knew that that was their code and their symbol. And I made the statement known publicly. There was going to be a major terrorist attack on 9/11, and it's all for your reaction. Many people were dumbfounded by this. I had people at my door angry, yelling at me, wondering how I knew. So I pose these questions to those that are in the know, those that have even dabbled in the magical realms. And tonight I'll pose these questions to Peter Lavinda. He is the author of The Dark Lord, H.P. Lovecraft, Kenneth Grant, and the Typhonian Tradition of Magic. He's authored numerous books such as the Sinister Forces series, highly recommended in understanding the extraterrestrial current that is making itself known now on planet Earth. His latest book is Hitler's Legacy, because all of this tends to connect back to occult rituals that the Nazis were performing, and even coming over into America, utilizing Freemasonry, corporate power, and the remaining Nazi scientists. At this point in the history, we are sitting when fireballs are raining down upon other nations, and they are calling for satisfaction, saying that the U.S. is using weather modification, meteor weapons against others. This is a very difficult thing to prove, although we have the X-37B up in the orbit for over 2 years, or almost 2 years, 675 days. And we don't know what it's doing up there. We don't know what it did up there. We have mysterious objects floating around in our atmosphere, being tracked by NORAD as dangerous objects, dangerous UFOs. In the Ural Mountains of Russia, night turned to day. A strange orange glow opened up over the sky. Now, as you know, because you listen to the Free Zone for all these years, because you understand that this situation is the one to be paying attention to, you are some of the fortunate that understand what can be going on. But there are still so many questions to understand. Is this an overarching force that is using the signs and symbols purposefully? Is there a reason that I'm seeing the mark of the beast from the Typhonian tradition all over? It's the Xbox logo, it's the X-Men logo, it's the X-Files logo. It's on Beyonce's album. It's everywhere I turn. This mark of the beast, the O and the X. The connections to the Klefot, the Fallen Ones, or the excrement, the 66, the W. Constant. Order 66 in Star Wars. So many things that connect this whole story. NASA has launched a flying saucer that they think is going to replace modern shuttles. We've had privatized rocket programs and national rocket programs exploding on the platform and crashing to Earth. Meanwhile, Miley Cyrus and Wayne Cohen of Flaming Lips are putting out religious alien artworks and Photoshop works of themselves as God aliens, right? A current coming to the surface. At the same time, we have Google X coming out with magnetic nanoparticles ready to seek out cancer in your body, seek out specific things within bodies. Nanoparticles running around you, trying to help you. This comes, of course, from their calico and byproduct of Google, their medical side, which is actually run by a man who used to run Genentech. He was a chairman of Google and also is chairman of Apple, on the board of Apple. These corporations connected with these occult symbols, the bitten apple with its mark of the beast operating system. Is this all coincidence? Well, tonight, as we talk with Peter Lavenda, I'm going to dig deep into the Typhonian tradition and this extraterrestrial current to understand whether or not this is actually a manipulation by humans on planet Earth that perhaps are being manipulated by an extraterrestrial source? Or is this a current, a stream of consciousness that is going through the cosmos and is now awakening on planet Earth to simply genetically cause us to open up to these new signs and symbols? Simply stated, are they purposely put there? Or is this something much stranger? So we'll turn now to Peter Lavenda. Check out his website, peterlavenda.com. Make sure to get all of his books, because this stuff is deep. And it's going to get a little bit weird in here. So if you feel yourself getting lost on the topics and understandings that we're discussing here, I highly recommend you go to freemantv.com, go to watch on the front page, and scroll down to lectures, and watch the many lectures that I have put up here for free on freemantv.com. And if this doesn't answer many of those questions, then go to listen and go to guest appearances, as I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of radio shows on many, many topics. You will find the heart of what I've been discussing with you all in the guest appearance section on freemantv.com. So without any further ado, I'm hoping Peter Labinda will help me to understand a bit more about the occult nature of what's been going on in my own experience. My wife and I made a little trip to London, and as we got there, we decided to go down and check out Treadwell's rare books. And I told the nice lady there that money was no object. Pull me out some of your most occult works and let me have a gander and see what I could pick up. And what I ended up with was Kenneth Grant's book called Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God. Now, as I opened this book, it seemed to open a whole new dimension to my understanding of what's going on planet Earth, as I realized and learned even an entire chapter based on the accursed nature of the number 11 and the sinister nature of 9. And I'm learning about 9-11 as I'm looking into this order. I find that the Mark of the Beast is the X-Men logo, the X-Files logo, and even the Xbox logo. And I'm starting to see the world as more of an occult force orchestrating situations of a political nature and political mechanizations to the point that we could actually start to predict what we will see in the political world, such as 9/11, or seeing in the corporate world, such as Macintosh using the Mark of the Beast as their new operating system logo. Do you think that there could be such a sinister force orchestrating events and encoding magical symbolism into political events like this?
Well, you can look at this as though it's a Manichaean struggle between forces of light and darkness, good and evil, and all of that. But that's a kind of a dualistic philosophy, and I don't know if that really obtains. I think when we're talking about this eruption of these kinds of symbols in cultural life, it may not necessarily imply that there is something evil in the moral sense taking place, but something certainly evidence of some darker force. And when I say darker, I mean something that's not seen, something that's not visible. I mean, the very word occult means hidden. It doesn't really mean evil. It means something that's hidden from public view. Now, we generally assume that if something is hidden from public view, it's got to be something salacious or something scandalous or something something wrong, something evil. And yet we have a history in the West of secret societies that seem to be benign. The people who meet in secret, they're initiated, then they go out into the world and, sometimes they do good deeds. I mean, it's really hard to draw a hard and fast line between good and evil in this sense, because the symbols that we come across are symbols of functions, of processes that are taking place for us as human beings on a deep unconscious level, perhaps, and in the world, perhaps on a quantum level. I don't like to use that word too much because it's overused and, people have different ideas about what it means. They're not always correct, but let's just say that on a subatomic level, if nothing else, that there are forces at work of which we are not aware consciously, but of which we may be aware subconsciously. And I think that the human race in general responds to these forces, responds to the kind of energy that's emitted by the activity of these forces. And I think that when you're looking at this, when you're looking at the X's and zeros that keep coming out, and when you look at all of this, there seems to be a zeitgeist, you know, there seems to be a spirit of the times that says, this is what's happening now. This is a symbol. This is a sign. It's evidence of the operation of some darker force. You know, in physics, they have dark matter and they have black holes. There are these associations with darkness and with things that are hidden and at the same time powerful. I think the most powerful things are things that are hidden. I think the things that we see, the things that we see every day are not necessarily those things that are the most powerful. But there's things that happen, even from a psychological point of view, our dreams are the evidence of the activity of darker forces. And what is, you know, in the human race, the best symbol of dreams, but, you know, the dream factory. We're talking about Hollywood. We're talking about the culture in general, representing the unconscious of the people. So it's perhaps a sign that there is something at work, something powerful that it's trying to manifest in our reality, that's trying to manifest in waking consciousness, and that the first intimations of this are these symbols. You know, it's a bit like we're living in Flatland, and there's this second dimensional or third dimensional force that's making itself felt little by little. And we all look at it differently and make different assumptions. And I think that these forces are coming to conscious realization among all of us. I think part of the situation that gave the impetus to this was perhaps this becoming aware of Asian religion, of Asian concepts of creation, Asian concepts of cosmology and cosmogony. I think these things, when the West and the East started to interact so strongly in the last 150 to 200 years, I think this is the beginning of that, the beginning of people who have one part of the puzzle talking to people who have the other part of the puzzle. And it's possibly this cross-fertilization that's contributing to this. You can look at the influence of occult ideas in Hollywood, but you also have to look at the influence of Asian religion in Hollywood, like Tibetan Buddhism being the most famous case, but other forms of religion as well, all making their way known through various personalities, through various celebrities, through film, as well as through books and through other types of media.
Absolutely. It is bubbling to the surface, without a doubt. But what I've learned is that behind the scenes of many of the things going on planet Earth, especially just at the heart of civilization and the creation of governments and space programs, is this extraterrestrial current to the idea that the Nazis were utilizing occult rituals in order to channel entities to find secrets for creating their technologies, or jet propulsion laboratories with Jack Parsons and having rituals to pan prior to launches, and even in connections with our nuclear powers and the potential of punching a hole into the aether, if you will, and opening a portal for this extraterrestrial current to come in. How much is that influencing our lives right now that people just aren't even aware of?
Well, we haven't really come to grips yet with perhaps the most important scientific event of the last 100 years, and that was the detonation of two atomic bombs in Japan. I think we haven't really come to grips with the fallout from that, literally and figuratively. I think that this particular event was something that itself would have blown a hole in the ether, just because it was that powerful and it was totally unprecedented and unexpected. Basically, we were beating the Nazis to the punch with this type of weapon because they were working on the same weapon at the same time. We had just managed to get ahead of them, especially where the heavy water problem was concerned. So we were actually racing with this force of evil, if you will, on the planet, the Nazis, in order to develop a weapon. I mean, both sides trying to develop the same kind of weapon that would have the same horrible effects. And it was the question of, you know, who gets it first? That's the winner. The Nazis, as I researched during the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so, I realized that they were sending parts of the weapon that they had already discovered to Japan. As the war was ending in Europe and Japan was still fighting, there was at least one submarine shipment that was taking place on which parts of the bomb, of the Nazi version of the atomic bomb, were contained, as well as rocket parts, engineering diagrams, even engineers. All of this was being sent to Japan as Germany was falling, so the Japanese would have had the capability not only of having an atomic weapon, but being able to deliver it, a delivery system which was based on the V-2 rocket. So, you know, this was taking place, and this, you know, this combination of a of the Nazi regime, which was basically a pagan regime. Walter Wernher von Braun, for instance, and Walter Dornberger, they were both people who had ranks in the SS or the SA or the German military. These were people who were true believers as well as scientists. So these are people who, I mean, Wernher von Braun himself, I believe, if I remember correctly, was a major in the SS. You don't become a major in the SS because you made a donation to the right guy, or, you know, this is not like the Rotary or something, or the Elks Club. To be a major in the SS meant that you were a true believer. You had passed all sorts of initiatory programs. You had to prove racial purity and all the rest of it, as well as ideological purity. These were the people that were involved in the creation of this device. And we eventually brought them to the United States to help jumpstart our own space program. I mean, the thing is, you know, it's wrapped in darkness. I mean, it's wrapped in the kind of evocation of dark forces. And we were oblivious in many cases, we the people in general, we were naive to think that it could be anything else, that, you know, we had the quote-unquote good Germans on our side. And good Germans there may be, but good Nazis there never were. And this is what the problem that we faced. So punching a hole in the ether was a combination of things. It was the bomb, the atomic bomb. It was, as you say, you know, Jack Parsons and Ron Hubbard out there in the desert invoking spiritual forces as well. It was in 1947. The Roswell incident was, again, a kind of evidence from our collective unconscious that something was taking place. It was also the same year that we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it was the same year, of course, that Aleister Crowley died. All of this was happening in 1947, just as we had formed the Central Intelligence Agency through the National Security Act. So all of this was being was happening in 1947 at that same year. And that's when the hole was punched. The bomb, of course, had fallen in 1945. And I think the ripples went out in all directions. And by 1947, we were in a tug of war with the Soviet Union and with China. We were getting ready to go to war in Korea. And of course, there was Vietnam, there was Cambodia, there was Laos, and the dominoes were falling. So to me, that period was critical. From 1945 to 47, that's when everything started to change for the worse, in a sense. This is when we made our pacts with the devil. We brought the Nazis over to work with us, just as the Soviet Union brought their Nazis over to work with them. And the Nazis, of course, only work for themselves. And that's essentially what took place. Because who were the first ones to put a rocket into space was the Soviet Union. Even though we had Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger and hundreds of other Nazi scientists on our side from Paperclip, the Soviet Union was still the first ones to get into space with the Sputnik. So you realize that there was a lot of collusion taking place between the Nazis in the East and the Nazis in the West. And this is what we didn't realize, but we did not understand. We thought the Nazis were simply a political party running Germany, that once Germany had lost the war, they would just give up and say, wow, you beat us, you know, we'll all be friends now, we'll shake hands, and, you know, like a couple of kids in the schoolyard, after having a fight, you know, they make up and all is forgiven, and that nothing could have been further from the truth.
Absolutely. And their experiments carried on, they moved and continued, and who knows where they're at now. I mean, they were designing flying saucers back then. And then where this belief system comes from, we look at the Thule Society that spawned the Nazi Party, and they're a psychical research investigation group that is channeling interdimensional beings. Or we look to the CIA, as you had mentioned, and they're raised out of skull and bones, practicing rituals there, not knowing what entities they're channeling. I'd really like to understand a little more about this concept of the trans-Plutonian connection of ritual magic that leads to creating things like the Bell program or even rockets and nukes.
Well, we as a country took all of this research very seriously, especially about 1950 or so, when we became scared to death that there was some strange Asian mind meld thing going on, which we call brainwashing or mind control. This was a reaction of our country, especially of our intelligence agencies and our military, to this perceived threat that was uncanny. Here we are in 1950, basically beginning a program that would have been the envy of a Renaissance emperor. I mean, we were going to hire alchemists, basically. We were going to hire magicians and sorcerers to help us fight, you know, the evil empire, the dreaded yellow peril. This was something that is unbelievable in the present-day context. We took, at face value, ideas that there were powers of the mind that could be controlled, that either using drugs, using hypnosis, using even torture, using psychological behavior modification techniques, things that are totally beyond the pale today, things that verge on torture or are torture. We utilized this beginning with the Korean War, and we kept utilizing this and practicing this for a good 20 to 30 years later that we know of. I mean, there are other programs that took advantage of some of this occult knowledge, if you will. As late as the 1980s and 1990s, there were, of course, the remote viewing experiments and all of that. All of this is predicated upon an occult view of the world, an occult view which is not consonant with a scientific view of the world. This is something that scientists would scoff at, and yet we spent millions and millions and millions of dollars investigating because we felt this was something that could bear fruit. We were going to open the black box of human consciousness. We were going to rearrange its contents. We were going to see what was in there. We were going to control the minds of human beings. We were going to initiate them, essentially, but without the safeguards of a regular initiation in a secret society. We were going to initiate them without any spiritual preparation. We were taking people off the street, in some cases literally, putting them through horrendous types of behavior and psychological manipulation in order to wipe their brains, to clear their memories, to replace them with other memories, to cause them to commit acts in a trance that they would later forget. All of these experiments were genuine. They were documented. They're represented by some of the declassified files of projects like MKUltra, Bluebird, Artichoke, and the others. And this was a government program. If anybody doubts that there was government involvement in anything like occult ritual, et cetera, maybe it sounds too speculative, it sounds too tinfoil hat-ish. All they have to do is go back to the records of MKUltra, go back to the programs that the CIA was seriously involved with, records that, for the most part, were destroyed by Dick Helms, Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA at the time during the 1970s when the whole Watergate thing was going on. He actually had these files shredded. He and Sidney Gottlieb, the doctor who was really pushing this through the CIA's programs, the technical services division and all this other stuff was going on. So you had people being trained to become assassins, being trained to become couriers, trained to do things they would never ordinarily do. You had people investigating psychotropic drugs, investigating different ways of really wiping out the conscious minds of people. For instance, the famous experiments that took place in Montreal, which ended, oddly enough, at the day that Kennedy was assassinated in November of 63. Ewan Cameron and his operations in Montreal, horrible experiments, torturing human beings, you know, putting microphones, speakers under their pillows, patients in mental wards, and having, you know, chanting going on constantly day and night. The effort was called depatterning, to get rid of the patterns of behavior and to cleanse the brain, to wipe it out completely so that the doctors could then input new memories and new ideas and a new personality from scratch. All of this taking place under the auspices of our intelligence agencies. What is this if not occultism? This is initiation. This is the kinds of things that go on after years of preparation in a monastery in Asia or among secret societies in Europe or the North America, where people train to cleanse themselves spiritually, to purify themselves. None of this was done. None of the safeguards were put in place. People's minds were taken and they were trashed by government scientists, G-scale doctors, who were there trying to figure out, you know, what can we do now? Can we get this guy to fire a weapon and then forget that he did it? How good is hypnosis? How good are the drugs? All of this is going on in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and beyond. This is occult practice. You don't need a bunch of guys in robes, you know, standing around a burning candle throwing incense, although that might have been taking place. But what you really need, what you really had to confront, was the fact that our scientists were actually taking out the formulas of occult initiation, of occult ritual, stripping them of the religious aspects of it, and trying to see if they could make it work for themselves in a laboratory setting. We had Andrea Puharich. Here was a man in the 1950s at the same time all of this was going on, giving lectures at Edgewood Arsenal to people in the Defense Department, to the Department of the Army, telling them how to weaponize psychic abilities. I mean, this is what our government was involved with, not to mention the Soviet Union, which was doing its own thing. And as far as we know, the Chinese government as well, and many governments around the world. But in particular, we know that our government was doing this, and that people who were peripherally involved with our government were also doing this. This was something that was the trend. This was something that people thought would be pretty cool if we could make it work. And if you look at the movies and the books that were published and written during that time, you're going to see, once again, the evidence, the symbolism of this was erupting into consciousness. You know, you had Rosemary's Baby at the time. You know, you had the Church of Satan, which was founded in 1966, at the height of all of this activity by the government. You had Timothy Leary. You know, you had all of these things were taking place on the surface that we could see, but they were just the symbols or the symptoms, let's say, the trace evidence of something that was going on much deeper, which was being funded by American taxpayers to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, which doesn't sound like a lot today, but which was, you know, real money back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And we find that Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, they were also channeling interdimensional or extraterrestrial entities that they believe were from Sirius. You know, this theme keeps coming into the situation that there is an outside force that is sending messages to certain people that perhaps are practicing ritual magic, or even the idea of the beginning of television, when we go back to the Golden Dawn and the creation of the Crookes tube, which became the cathode ray tube of our television, and this coming through Golden Dawn ritual and the attempts of making communication with these interdimensional beings. And now that was picked up by the Nazi corporation Telefunken and carried out to all the homes in the world, to the point that the Blue Beam Project was believed to actually be set up to channel demons into people's souls using fiber optic lines and these new technologies. So every time we keep coming back to, as we look at our modern world and the bitten apple on my Macintosh and the Mark of the Beast as their operating system, and I keep finding that these people actually are, you know, you mentioned Pluharich, these people are channeling extra-dimensional or extraterrestrial currents that they are bringing into our modern culture, right?
Well, in Pluharich's case, this was, you know, obviously true. He wrote about it. He bragged about it. The documentation is there for all to see. I mean, here was Puharich, a person who had been trained as a medical doctor, who had a commission in the United States Army, who was deeply involved in psychic research, who then conducts a seance in the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War, at his farm up in Maine, to which, you know, members of America's most titled families, the Blue Blood families of America, were in attendance. The Forbes and the Astors and the DuPonts were in a circle, and the deliberate attempt was there just to channel extra, you know, terrestrial entities, the Nine, the famous seance involving the Nine. There were nine people at this particular seance, and according to the medium who was transmitting this information, there were nine beings floating above the earth in some sort of a vehicle who were going to use these nine to effectively cleanse the earth and to create a new world. A brave new world was going to be created using these particular people as venues, as mediums for this change. The only documented case where this might have been true since the 1950s, since that first seance of the Nine, was in the case of Arthur Young, who was present at that seance, the inventor of the Bell helicopter, a man who was intimately involved with our rocket program in a way through the helicopters, through different types of technology involving aerospace inventions that he was involved with, and his wife, Ruth Forbes Payne Young. These are people who are deeply involved in psychic phenomena research and occultism and studying the deep structure of the universe. And Arthur Young's daughter-in-law is a woman who was living in Dallas, Texas, who befriended Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald. So we have Lee Oswald and Marina living in her house at one point. She helps Lee Oswald get the job at the Texas School Book Depository. And about 2 months before the assassination, she goes up to visit Arthur Young, one of the original members of the Nine. We don't know what they discussed. She must, however, have been telling him about the strange Russian woman living with her and her American defector husband. And then, as we find out later, of course, she's the one who basically put the nail in Lee Harvey Oswald's coffin by giving all the evidence to the police when they showed up at her house, and by not arranging for him to get a lawyer when he desperately needed one. All of this through Ruth Payne in Texas, and then from Ruth Payne to Arthur Young, one of the Nine. And then we find out that another intimate of Lee Oswald was George de Morenschild, a very strange character. An oil man, evidently, or a geologist who specialized in oil, who was a white Russian, an emigre, or who was involved with the white Russian networks in Texas. And it turns out that when he committed suicide, just before he was supposed to testify before the House Subcommittee on Assassinations, we find in his address book the name of another member of the Nine, somebody else who was intimately involved with that particular group that was doing having that seance up in Maine. So Lee Oswald didn't have a chance. I mean, he had people who were connected with this tiny group that met in Maine in 1952 and 53. With this tiny group, he had connections with at least two of the members without really realizing it. So was the assassination of President Kennedy, one of the most beloved presidents, and at the same time one of the most hated presidents in American history, was that assassination part of the overall plan of the Nine to, quote-unquote, cleanse the planet? Cleanse the planet of what, you know, exactly? We're not really quite sure.
Yeah.
But here, no, this is what you have, though. I mean, you don't need to look much further than American history itself and the people who openly admit what they were up to and then make the connections. I mean, just connect the dots. The dots are there. Their dots are in the Warren Commission testimony. They're there, you know, they're there in the evidence of the assassinations. They're there in Andrei Puharich's own writings. It's all over the place.
Well, the Nine, they are referred to as the Ennead in the Egyptian pantheon. Is this correct? The nine gods, such as Osiris, Nuit, Set, and Geb.
Well, if we want to draw that connection, it's possible. There was an Ennead, of course, in Egyptian mythology, at least Egyptian religion, rather, at least, you know, at a certain point in history. We can infer that these are the same, but there's connections also to Asian religions as well, and to, you know, there's nines everywhere. They sort of proliferate throughout comparative religion. But
well, also in the Church of Satan and the Temple of Set, they both have their councils of nine.
Sure, and the tradition of the nine unknown men, who are supposed to be secret members of the human race, who are repositories of information. As one is ready to die, they pass the information on to someone else. You know, secret information as to how the universe actually functions. So do we consider the Egyptian gods evil? Do we consider them extraterrestrial? Do we consider them nine human beings who are, you know, caretakers of some sacred knowledge? All of these things could be true.
Well, Uri Geller was one of these channels that they used for the Nine, and he later came out saying they were tricksters in a spaceship called Spectra, and that they were perhaps a supercomputer. He then ran off with Michael Jackson, attempting to find some transhumanism, seeking robotic bodies for his soul, and even the potential of hiring or getting a clone from Clone Aid. Does this transhumanist agenda also fit in as far as, do you think, with Uri Geller and the connection of transhumanism in the Nine?
Well, I mean, the concept of transhumanism, I think, really began about 100-some-odd years ago when Helen Blavatsky started writing about, you know, spiritual evolution, the evolution of different races and the creation of new races. I think the transhumanistic concept has its roots there. And the Nazis, of course, took this up in a very strong and very determined way. They believed that if evolution was, in fact, what was taking place on the planet, then since we are conscious of it, we are conscious beings, then we have a responsibility, according to the Nazis, to become, you know, consciously involved in evolution. And this would mean everything from the Holocaust to cybernetics and everything else in between. So the idea that we want to create the next level of evolution, we want to create the new man, as they called it. They called the new man both in the fascist and the Nazi circles, and they called it the new man in socialist and communist circles as well. The idea that we're going to create a new type of human being, which, for want of a better term, we're calling transhuman now. But in those days, this was a very real concept. People actually believed in it. They believed that eugenics would help us get there, that we wipe out the sick and the infirm first, and we go from there to wipe out races that we, in our own mind, were dragging back, dragging down the human race, and clean them out, and then eventually create one strand of DNA, basically. Of course, from the point of view of genetics, this was a dead end. If you don't have the intermarriage, you don't have the intermixture of the genetic material, you're eventually going to be inbreeding to the point where you may doubt whether you're creating a super race or an inferior one. But that didn't hold them back. That didn't hold back the Nazis or anyone else who completely believed that evolution could be channeled and controlled, and that there were enlightened people, enlightened beings among us, who represented that next stage and who were going to help us get to that next level, bring all of humanity up to the next transhuman level. This has been a dream, I think, for a long time, but in the case of the 150 years or so since Darwin, this has suddenly become something that some people felt they could consciously control and therefore bring about through force, through science, through violence, through whatever means necessary, and bring about the next stage of evolution. So it's not surprising that you'll have Uri Geller, running off with Michael Jackson, trying to find some robotic clone type of a situation. We had Walt Disney famously being frozen until such future date as he could be revived, and all this other stuff was going on, all cryogenics as well as cybernetics and all the robotic stuff. There is this idea, especially among very wealthy and very powerful people, that they can preserve themselves for the future and preserve their intelligence, preserve their will, and preserve their bloodline, quite frankly.
Right. They want to stick around. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, absolutely. They want to stick around while the rest of us are gone. I mean, that's the corollary to all of this. It's not that they're trying to make all of us stick around. It's only going to be a few that are going to stick around.
Yeah.
They don't possibly want the whole race to stick around. That would be counterproductive in the extreme. They want to be the ones who are left when everything else is turned to dust and they inherit the earth.
Yeah, and we find that we're at a current time where Ra'el is coming before Congress and saying that eternal life can be ours. I mean, it really is. We're at that point in history right now.
Well, yeah, we are at that point. At the same time as we're talking on the one side of our face about eternal life, on the other side we're looking at the possibility of mass extinction.
Right.
So it's pretty funny. We have the alpha and the omega there. I mean, we have both sides taking place. And are they really opposite, or are they part of the same coin? Is mass extinction going to be necessary for this new age to take place, for this this ultimate life form to emerge? And that's the scary part.
Right. And who are they talking to? I mean, again and again, we're finding that they're performing occult rituals in order to make connections with these extraterrestrial beings. You know, who is running the show is something I'd like to know.
Well, we surely don't know. No one's going to come out and tell us. And if they did tell us, quite bluntly, we wouldn't believe them.
Exactly.
And it's quite possible they have already told us, and we just haven't been paying attention.
True enough. True enough. They definitely put enough of it out there for us. Well, I wanted to jump to the OTO just a little bit, because
sure.
they claim to be Internet or Illuminati 2.0. And when I'm looking at society and I'm looking at the signs and symbols, even to the point of Jay-Z wearing a shirt that says, "Do what thou wilt." And I'm seeing a massive influence by the Ordo Templi Orientis, or at least the concepts utilized inside of this occult order, coming out into our current theme, and definitely bringing about the Aeon of Horus. I don't see anyone discussing the OTO. I hear Illuminati, and I'm like, who are those guys? But the OTO, we can pinpoint them. We can say, look, this is an influence. You know, we can see it in the music industry where we see the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, on up to Tool, all being avid Aleister Crowley fans. We find Kenneth Anger in the early days or in Hollywood. We find constant rise of the Ordo Templi Orientis, and not a soul is talking about it.
Well, that's not for want of trying, I think, as far as the OTO is concerned. I've known members of the order for many, many years. I mean, really going back to the 70s. And I've met on several occasions Grady McMurtry, who was the head of the order in the United States at the time. I've met a lot of people who are involved in the order and some of the current membership as well. The cultural influence that Crowley has is not to be denied. I mean, it's growing every day. There's a new academic appreciation for Crowley and the writings of Crowley. You can, for instance, go to a lot of the publications that are coming out of the Netherlands, coming out of the people around Walter, spaced on his name. Anyway, Henrik Bogdan and some of the other writers and thinkers who are writing about the Western esotericism, the new academic field of Western esotericism, they're writing considerably about Crowley. Crowley is becoming an accepted form of academic study now. So you're able to see that he's having an influence at the academic level, and his writings are having an influence certainly on the cultural level as more and more people become involved. I think Scientology, in a sense, paved the way for some of this, because Scientology basically owes a lot of its origins to Crowley and to the OTO. L. Ron Hubbard cut his teeth on occultism with Jack Parsons, the one you mentioned, the rocket scientist, who was involved in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These two were conducting rituals together, and Parsons was running the OTO in California at the time. So there's this idea that, if you go to Hollywood and you sort of mingle with the celebrities, you can get greater acceptance. And I think the Order, either through Scientology on its own or by itself, has been making those connections successfully to a certain extent, and that people are becoming more and more aware of the OTO and of Crowley, and of the OTO as the vehicle for Crowley's teaching. And I think this is what's, something that's really taking place in a very serious way, not just in Hollywood, but in other aspects of cultural life. You're going to find a lot more references to it in popular literature. You're going to find references to it in movies and music among celebrities. It's going to be growing. It's not going to disappear. And this is, whether this is a nefarious thing or whether this is something that is strictly benign, in a way, if you can consider Crowley benign, if you can consider, Thelema and the OTO benign, this remains to be seen.
It seems that this is a very difficult question to answer. The idea of this communication with the extraterrestrial current. Now, you have your book, The Dark Lord, and we start to get into the Typhonian tradition. And as I understand it, Typhon would be the Lord of the Abyss, if you will, and that the connections in this is the idea of communication with interdimensional beings.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that was Kenneth Grant's whole thing. I mean, his idea was that, we tend to think of these things in terms of little boxes. So magic is in one box, and, UFOs or extraterrestrial life forms are in a different box, and these two don't meet. To Kenneth Grant, that was not so. He used the ideas of Lovecraft, for instance, very heavily. And to Lovecraft, the extraterrestrial beings were also occult beings. You could summon them through magic, and you would summon alien life forms, basically. So this is something that Kenneth Grant sunk his teeth into and decided that he would explore as far as he possibly could. And that resulted in the Typhonian trilogies, I mean, a set of 9 books, which really explore this type of universe very thoroughly in a confused manner for those who have not really studied the Golden Dawn and Crowley and Lovecraft and Asian religion and Afro-Caribbean religion and all the rest. But it's there. He believed that all of occultism basically spoke about connections with the other side. So Typhon was the symbol of going through the quote-unquote the abyss. It was going through this dark place where once you passed through it, you were then in contact with powerful forces that were not conscious to most human beings, things that were that dwelled really way below conscious awareness, but yet were responsible for some of the things we've been talking about already, some of the evidence of the activity of these forces. Grant wanted to go there. He wanted to, through ritual, he wanted to approach these extraterrestrial beings, this extraterrestrial existence. And Typhon was the symbol for that. Typhon was the symbol of, you know, the initiator, the spirit guide through which you would go in order to go through the tunnels of Set. You would look at the back of the tree of life, you know, through that missing sephira called Da'at, and try to achieve some kind of unity there.
I've spoken with many magicians that discuss the idea of the Klefot and the hidden sephirah inside Da'at. Strangely, you're presenting this to an audience that actually understands what these words mean. Mm-hmm. Now, some magicians present that you have to go through this. Now, the Klefot, the so-called fallen angels, or what's known as excrement or shells inside of the magical tradition, is our own personal demons that have to be confronted. Do you agree with this magical understanding of the Klefot, that this is just the dark side of the soul that every human should face in order to rise to illumination?
Well, you know, they say all politics is personal or all politics is local. It's the same thing with this. We live in a world that is basically a creation. It's a figment of the imagination of a magician somewhere. We're living in a world that is an illusion for the most part. According to Asian religion, this is a very familiar concept. So when we're talking about the Klefot, we're talking about the shells, we're talking about something that happened at the time of creation. But it's analogous to the personal demons that we all have, imbalances within ourselves, to put it in a kind of a New Agey context, which doesn't really do the concept justice. These are, because they're imbalanced, because they are not complete personalities, they are frightening. They're as frightening as psychopaths are to us, or serial killers, people who seem to be missing an aspect of personality that we all think should be there in every human being. They may be missing something. They have dead eyes. You know, they have no compassion or no sympathy or no empathy. These are beings that are lacking some essential part of what we would consider necessary for being human. That's why they are shells. They're broken off pieces. According to Kabbalistic tradition, they're actually broken pieces of one particular sefirot in particular, and that would be Gevura, the sphere of Mars, which is why a five-pointed star is protection against them, because the five-pointed star is related to the fifth sefirot, which is Gevura, which is Mars. Therefore, the shells all came from that one particular sphere, which was broken through some kind of an accident, some kind of cosmic or celestial accident, and then they peopled the universe with these broken pieces. So they represent parts that have no connection to the other parts. These are standalone idiosyncrasies. These are standalone violent attitudes. These are things that are not have no human nature to begin with. I've often told people that when you're involved in ceremonial magic, when you're involved in a cult ritual of any type, there are moments when one can confront or be confronted by a spiritual force. And when one does have that experience, what you realize quite quickly is that these forces, even if they're anthropomorphic, even if they look like they're human or humanoid or seem to have human characteristics, they're not. And you feel immediately that you're in the presence of something that's non-human. Which is made even worse by the fact that they may appear to be human. You know, most people that we meet during the course of our lives, we can pigeonhole in specific categories. You meet somebody and you kind of put them in a category that says, oh, I met a guy like this once before, I met a woman like this once before, and you kind of put them in these categories. They fit into little boxes. The spiritual forces that one meets, especially when you're talking about the Klefot, they're not identifiable through experience, through past experience of human beings. This is a personality, for want of a better word, that has no relationship to anything one has ever experienced in life. So the Klipa can, in a sense, represent parts of yourself that are uneven, that are imbalanced, that are broken, things that have to be mended. As Israel Regardi often said, you should never begin practice in magic unless you've gone through a few years of psychoanalysis first, just to find out where these things might be lurking when you start to become involved in this practice. But for want of a better word, let's say that these are undeveloped parts of the human psyche, things that we would be shocked to learn actually exist within ourselves.
All right. Have you yourself ever practiced ritual magic?
You know, these are the kinds of questions I never actually answer.
Okay.
whether to say yes or no. If I said no, nobody would believe me. If I said yes, you'd want more details. So it's a question of, let's just leave that question hanging for a while. Okay. Of course, I've had experiences. I've had experiences that could be called paranormal. I've written about them. I'm not shy about them. But performing ceremonial magic implies an act of voluntary action, implies an act of will. And those are the things that we keep to ourselves.
Gotcha. I can understand that. Well, his name is Peter Lavinda, and he is a prolific author. Tantric Temples and the Eros of Magic in Java, Ratline, the Soviet Spies, Nazi Priest and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler, The Angel and the Sorcerer, not to mention all of the Sinister Forces, which are just amazing books, and so in-depth, Peter. Oh my God, your work takes me a long time to get through.
Takes me a long time to write them, I can tell you.
I bet. This is a topic that just, you know, you're a one and only out there, Peter. I don't know of anyone else that is really, plumbing the depths of these occult realms. And I look forward to us digging deeper and deeper in the next hour. But at this point, I want to give you a little break. And so I thought, let's tell everybody where they can pick up your books, because everybody definitely needs to understand this, to understand what is going on in our political mechanizations right now.
Well, of course, all the usual suspects. Everything is available on Amazon. Barnes & Noble is carrying my latest book, which is called The Hitler Legacy, which is about the relationship between the post-war Nazi underground and the rise of terrorism, specifically Islamic, quote-unquote, terrorism. That's what I've spent the last few years researching all over the world. So this might be an eye-opener. That's available at Barnes & Noble as well as on Amazon. And all my other books are available on Amazon without a problem.
And your website?
Yeah, you can. I have a new website, which is... I've been involved in trying to set up for a while. It's my name. It's peterlavenda.com.
Easy enough.
And it's easy enough. And from there, you'll have links to the Sinister Forces websites and to Hitler Legacy, Ratline, and Tantric Temples websites.
Amazing stuff, Peter. I tell you, I'm sitting here with the Dark Lord right now, the book, not himself, and, just plumbing through the depths of this, and it really does help that we have some background on this show into these occult orders and how this all, but, so much understanding necessary to realize what the point and purpose of all of this is. So we'll pick this up on the other side and get a little deeper into the mysteries of the Trans-Plutonian Order and getting deeper into the Aeon of Horus and just anywhere you want to go with this, Peter, for sure. So we'll be right back. Thank you all for tuning in.